On today's Sherpa Founder Series, we speak with Saul Orwell, successful multimillionaire, self-made by the age of 23. Saul is the founder of Examine.com. He's been featured on Men's Health and Fitness Magazine front covers. Saul is a brilliant entrepreneur. Anyone in the startup industry wants to hear his spectacular advice. First, serious about online trading? Secure your funds, keep your merchandise safe, and use a company that keeps the buyer and seller protected the whole way through. That's escrow.com. Payments you can trust. Hey, Sherpa Network, I'm Tess Diaz. Thanks for joining us today. We have Saul Orwell, who is a very tough guy to introduce. Serial entrepreneur, best known for his work at Examine.com. Saul, thank you for joining us today from Toronto. How you doing?
First of all, it's my pleasure. Secondly, not so bad. It's been, it's one of those like weeks where it's just downpouring the entire week and I regret my life choices of being an immigrant in Toronto. But, I'm sure the sun will come out soon and, you know, I'll be basking in the Canadian superiority. That's right. I'm starting it off with a bang.
But yes, oh, wow. Canadian.
Well, Tess is actually like kind of Canadian, aren't you?
100%. I am both Canadian and U.S. citizen. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad there's at least 50% awesomeness in you. Good to hear about that.
Well, that's funny you say, because I heard that your time, so I'm in Phoenix now. I heard your time in Phoenix, you describe as your lost years. So
ooh.
We are starting with a bang. And Drew Rosner, CEO of MediaOptions.com, thank you for joining us too. You and Saul have a long history, and I think it will be a lot of extra fun to have both of you together.
For sure.
Drew's not so sure, I guess.
So, yeah, no, I'm very sure, very sure. I think, you know, Saul and I have had a lot of sort of close encounters, but we've continuously missed each other a number of times in visits. We've got a couple of friends in common, but one in particular, Chris Crowther, who was also a former business partner of each of us, I believe. That was, I think, how we first were introduced.
I remember actually, this was in Panama and we were in his condo apartment, whatever you want to call it. And we were on the balcony and you were walking, cause it was in Casco Viejo, and you were like walking on the street. And I don't know, something was going on. I think Carnival was about to begin. And like, we were just like yelling at each other from like three floors of a different, I think that was our actual first meeting through Chris was from the balcony and street.
Yep. I remember that.
Sounds
a lot of good times from that balcony, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, yeah.
On that balcony, Drew, didn't you say a movie for about Pablo Escobar was filmed from your balcony?
No. This is that was filmed from our house. And we're talking about Chris Crowther's apartment, which is, you know, two blocks from the house.
Very nice. Well, I'm sure that Panama misses you. Drew would walk around there and he was like the Don. Like, everybody'd come running up, shaking his hand. How you doing?
Well, when I moved there was only like, you know, literally less than 10 people who, you know, less than 10 gringos, let's say. Gringos being all, you know, Americans, Canadians, and Westerners in one lump sum. And so, you know, I was there for a decade. So it was, you know, it kind of just become known.
I was actually going to move to Panama about 8 years ago because of people like Chris and you, where it seemed like a pretty casual but relaxed and entertaining life. I just so happened to run into a woman 1 month before I left. I'd actually given up my lease and everything. And 7 years later, here we are still together and I'm not in Panama. So I was going to join that life, but so close, but I think it worked out that it didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to have a missed connection. Better to miss it with Drew than with this lovely lady in your life.
Exactly. And like, I'm getting enough Drew right now. So it, you know, it worked out at the end of the day regardless. So it's all good.
Drew, I think you need to like rub your head now.
On the, so sort of, you know, just getting into it a little bit about, you know, for those of our audience who haven't seen the first interview with Saul, I know that one of my first impressions, based on the sort of mythical figure that Chris had painted me, you know, he Chris, I think, you know, holds you in a very high regard, as you probably do him. And when Chris was explaining his buddy Saul, who was, you know, this really cool entrepreneur guy doing all these different cool things, and not just all these different cool things, but doing them in a really cool way. And it was kind of the first, my first encounter with the concept of digital nomad, whether you still, you know, agree with or adopt or like that moniker. You know, I haven't found a better one. And I think you and I both sort of share the dope digital nomad lifestyle. But I think you were kind of, I mean, okay, yes, I had sort of given up my life and moved to Panama and starting a digital business. And so I fit the bill, but you were doing it successfully already. And I was just getting started at that time. So, you know, you were kind of my first introduction into that. And you know, the way that Chris was sort of describing your lifestyle to me, I was like, shit, I want to do that. Like, that's how I, you know, that's how I want to make my business, because Saul's like on vacation 3 or 4 or 5 months a year. And, you know, works like, you know, he's like, you're like
the poster boy of a 4-hour work week.
Exactly.
If I wasn't so milk chocolatey, you see me blushing right now. My God, but please continue.
So yeah, that concept of like lifestyle design that you can't just make the decision to do it differently than everybody else is doing it. You know, you were kind of, you know, I have a horrible memory, but probably one of, if not the first person that I sort of came to know in close contact, that
Drew's cutting out a little, but what he's saying is you were the first one to actually do it even before it was cool.
So if I can explain a little bit of this. So it's funny, right? When we look back in hindsight, to just give a context to people, we're talking about like 10 years ago when we first met each other in Panama, roughly around then. Back then, first of all, digital nomadism was still relatively new. It's very trendy and in vogue today, right? Everyone's doing these yoga retreats and all that kind of stuff even. And also back then, if you had a business, if you're an entrepreneur, your only goal was to make money. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I used to tell people like, oh, you know, I have a business and I'm enjoying myself. And people would say like, they didn't understand that context of like a lifestyle business, right? Or being like, I don't need to maximize money. Even the more famous one was definitely 37 Signals with Basecamp and whatnot, where they were like, nah, money's not everything we need to make. And people were like, what is wrong with you? But the truth for me, it's interesting. It wasn't serendipitous or anything like that. I'm an immigrant. I'm ethnically Kashmiri, which was Pakistan and India keep fighting over. And I was born in Pakistan. And my dad worked for a Saudi petrochemical company. And when he joined as a Pakistani citizen. And as a Pakistani citizen, he could only get promoted until manager. Now, if he had joined as a Western citizen, he could become general manager. So when we became Canadians, my dad was still working for the same company. He applied to become a general manager and they're like, nope, you came to us as a Pakistani, you'll always be a Pakistani to us. And that was one of the most absurd things I'd ever heard of. I'm like, how does his birth have anything to do with any of his talents, right? We talk about meritocracy. Sure. I was like, this makes no sense. And so to me, entrepreneurship and like we talk about lifestyle business, all of it to me was just, I want to be independent. I didn't want to be famous, right? I didn't want to be the brand. I didn't want to be the person. In fact, I think, Drew, when we met, I had my original name. I legally changed my name because I didn't get to change it. Like, that's how independent-minded I am. So, like, I look back and it was like, oh, you know, you were so smart. You needed to do this. Or, like, you weren't focused over money. Nah, it was more just I wanted to be left alone. And I was a fat, shy nerd. I had a computer engineering degree. And I was able to figure out some online stuff that worked for me. And I was like, awesome. I'm making some money. I'm living the life. Why should I stress myself out? When, thankfully, I also didn't have any, like, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but like expensive tastes, right? I didn't drink alcohol at the time. I didn't really care about fast cars, big houses, whatever. So it afforded me the ability to be like, all right, instead I'm just going to bum around and live wherever I want. And it worked out.
I think that sums up a lot of what I've sort of respected about you, aside from being, you know, a first mover in this, what is now, like you said, super trendy, super popular. You know, it's like what everybody strives to not everybody, but you know,
sure,
a lot of people are striving for
the dream.
But it comes down to the simple fact that, you know, you were valuing two things above everything else, and that was experiences and time. And you know, ultimately, time I think is the most valuable underlying currency of everything today, but people don't see it for what it is. And you were, you know, putting time as the highest value commodity you had, and valuing experiences over material things. And it's funny how that works. When you value your experiences, it puts you in positions to earn more money, because you just simply experience more things, understand more things, understand more people and more cultures. And the more you know, the more you know, the more you can.
It's interesting, right? We talk a lot about, especially nowadays online when it's personal brands, we talk a lot about like superpowers, like what are you the best at? But the reality of it is that the smartest people, I think, or the most successful people, and there's studies that show this too, are the ones who have the most varied interests. Because the like one of my favorite examples is, I'm going to butcher this example, but I hope it elucidates what I'm trying to get at. Basically, there's this disease where your body starts slowly like killing itself. And one of the ways to treat it that's very experimental and most people don't know is essentially you irradiate the hell out of the body. So it kills all the white blood cells, which is what's kind of corrupted. And you need to be put in one of those bubbles, and you need to re-inject with white blood cells that have been created out of your stem cells, out of your bone marrow. And those are two completely different disciplines of medicine, right? One of them is disease and the other one is the actual radiation. And then the other one is the creation of the white blood cells. And unless you know all three, that is not an option. And so most doctors don't know, because they're so focused on being an anesthesiologist, being a radiologist, that they don't understand, wait a minute, we could do this and then this. So I think that's one of the downsides of the internet today, is we're so focused on only one thing or maybe two things, that it's the breadth that gives you the ability to go deep in interesting ways. You know, polymath, as they're called today, Renaissance man's back in the day. Without that interdisciplinary approach, you kind of just become an echo chamber, and it's almost becomes like a circle jerk at the end of the day, because you're just sharing the same information, just drilling deeper and deeper into the same hole instead of widening the hole. So
now,
welcome to today's media.
But Saul, you know what you're saying? I see that you've set up the structure where you can do that, not only yourself to support your varied interests, but also by surrounding yourself with people whom you trust to delegate your business to, and who have you know, varied areas of expertise themselves. And I know at least many years ago you had, or you said that many years ago you actually paid your number two guy more than you paid yourself, because that enabled you to travel, live the lifestyle you wanted, but also to pursue expanding your vision. Do you still see things that way? Did you do that at the time because you thought it was a brilliant business move, or just because you were super young, like 23 and ready to retire?
Definitely the more
that way, or it just happened and you realized that was brilliant.
So on the first level of it, I think a lot of we talk about like you're the average of the five friends around you and all that kind of stuff. I think the same stuff applies to anything you consume. And my easiest example is books, right? Like people will be like, oh yeah, you have access to A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Of course you know this stuff. One of my favorite examples is Leonardo da Vinci's diary. They you know, they were looking through it. And basically like 80% of his day was go to talk to expert X about X, go to expert Y about Y, go to expert Z about Z. So you, sometimes you look at this and you reverse engineer and you're like, man, I don't have access to all these experts. But also it depends on what kind of books you're reading. Like right now I'm reading, I usually read like 3 to 5 books simultaneously. So I'm reading one about like history, which is by Pulitzer Prize winner Will Durant. I'm reading a book about building science. I'm reading a book called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is just now a Netflix documentary that just came out. I'm reading a book on fiction. So the idea is that it's not just about the people around you, right? If you're disseminating information from different sources, you start seeing the links. In regards to then, you know, having paying your number two more than me, I got to be honest, I am a bleeding heart progressive kind of thing where I'm like, yo, the guy is working harder than me. Yeah, I founded it, but he's putting in all the hard work. I own the company, so I can do whatever I want when I want. But if he's the one, or she obviously in this case, is the one running it and has a headache, why the hell am I thinking I'm so important that I should be paid 100x or whatever, right? The ridiculousness of it. The other part of it too is though is, if we treat the business as an asset, similar to like a real estate vehicle, then it makes more sense to put money into the asset and appreciate the value because it'll be much faster and stronger than, you know, real estate itself, ETFs, index stock, whatever. So to me, it was like, okay, if I'm making enough money to do what I want, at no point am I struggling like, oh man, I wish I could do this. Oh man, I wish I could do that. Why not? As an example, like I'm about to go on a trip for a month. It's a pretty expensive trip relatively, but at no point did I have to like take extra money out, right? At no point did I have to struggle. Like being an adult includes saving for money, planning for the future, that kind of stuff. So it was more just an approach of let's be responsible. And what's been awesome for me is if there's one thing I'm proud of is my employee turnover is almost zero basically because one, I let them get them famous, right? If there's a quote in a magazine or newspaper, they can get quoted. Well, like I'm not the expert. And two, they know I'm not just some guy who is making a ton of money off their back. Instead, I'm like, let's build this together. Let's compensate you accordingly. And we're good. Just as an example, I was just reading, I don't want to make it political, but I was reading this GQ, the latest GQ magazine. They were talking about a woman who's a transgendered lady who's running for governorship in Vermont or Maine, Vermont, I think. And she was the CEO of the second largest energy company. And she paid herself $30,000 more than, you know, the next highest paid person. And to me, I was like, 30,000 is a lot, but it's not a lot in the current day and age. So why not? Yeah, she's the boss. Yeah, she makes more money, but does she really deserve, and this is an argument we can have later, whatever, but like, does she really need $1 million a year more? Because why? So that's always been my approach is like, man, we're in this as a team. We're going to work on this as a team, but it just seems weird when the compensation is heavily skewed into one direction than the other. So yeah.
Yeah, and I hear you say it because I've in some of the podcasts I listened to, saw where you've spoken before, you've said that your employees have essentially, you know, they've built their own personal brands, so to speak. Their own names are recognized. They've been quoted and referenced. And that is, so that to you, you treat them like an asset that is appreciating. And then what's most interesting is that they don't leave, that they, you know, I heard you say, certainly, you know, there's a loyalty that's built because you've
for sure
helped build them to this level. And there's a real partnership in that, but also, they'll never get as large an audience as they get at Examine. Would
for sure.
If you didn't have such a large, so for another entrepreneur who's listening to this, right? If they don't have such a large audience, besides your, you know, personal values of how you want to treat people on a business level, would you still advise that?
Yeah, because here's the thing. You know, examine.com is big now. We can push weight, all that kind of stuff. But to me, it's basically a mutually beneficial relationship. So in the context of examine.com, the emails that go out, the front man is Kamal Patel. Everyone thinks he owns the company. You go to the about page, he's the first person listed. You, in fact, you scroll down the about page, I'm like way near the bottom. I'm director of strategy or some whatever the hell, right? You're like, oh, this guy's an idiot. Who cares? It's these little things that signal to your employees or your founders, whatever you, however you've set it up, that it's not about me, which is a lot of the time what happens in such organizations. The other side of it too, though, is like,
if I can just interject though for 1 second, like, so I'm the antithesis of that, where I have been in the building of our business, where, you know, I was horrible at delegating, and I'm getting gradually better. And I, unfortunately, I built the whole organization around me. And so while that has had its benefits as we were growing, we're now at a point where the company is not me anymore. And, you know, I am just one cog in the wheel of commerce here. And so, but as far as like the general public believes and the industry, it's like Media Options, Andrew Rosner, Media Options, one and the same. And that's not only not true, but it's not the effect or the aesthetic that I want in any way whatsoever. It's also not true. So that helped me grow in a lean and efficient way, obviously much slower than we could have grown. But it got me to a place where now I have to reverse a lot of that. And that's hard to
do. There's benefits to both, right? Like it's easier to build an organization around your own name because it's you, right? The people will connect with an individual much more easily than they'll connect with a company. The downside, as you've obviously experienced, is it's a much bigger headache. But the way, so one thing I just wanted to go on a tangent on delegation, and I've been kind of obsessed with this idea. Yeah. My friend Wes Kao, who was basically director of special projects for Seth Godin, she was like behind the ideation, creation of Alt MBA, all that stuff. She has basically like three levels of employees. They're the first ones who give you insight. They're like, hey, there's a problem here. I'm like, cool, that doesn't help me at all. Second level is they come in with insights and they give you recommendations. And they're like, oh, these are our options. Now, on the face of it, this looks like the right way to do it, but it's also terrible because the employee is not taking any ownership of the problem. Right, there. You are still basically have the stress of being the one who picks the thing, and then the third level to go for is assertion, where the employee goes like, here's the problem. Here's things we could do. We should do this one because A, B, C, D. Now they're vested into the organization, and the reason I mention this because it loops back to what was being asked is, you know, it's a lot of like loyalty or employee appreciation is what can you do for them that they may not normally be able to do. So a level of that, for example, is I've wrapped for season tickets. So I will give them randomly here and there to my employees. The cookie off, that is something unparalleled that no one has access to that they all get access to. And not just they all get access to it, but they can then go freely talk to anyone who's at the event. A friend of mine is doing like a care package for the homeless for wintertime. Obviously, Toronto winters are a little bit intense. And so I asked around, I'm like, hey, where can I buy some wholesale supplies? And had a bunch of friends refer me to someone else. So it's not just about, hey, man, the company's going to build your brand. It's like, hey, man, I'm going to help you do what you're trying to do. And you're trying to do isn't necessarily just on the professional side. It's like what matters to you personally, right? What is the stuff that's important? For example, Kamal's a big NBA fan, and I love the NBA. Him and I argue about the NBA all the time. I've written him off multiple times where he was like, yeah.
You know I used to work for the Boston Celtics, right?
Oh, no, I didn't. Shit. We got that's a separate conversation. Doesn't matter. The Raptors are going to kick the Celtics' ass this year anywho. So, you know, enjoy that field.
Zero. There's a 0% chance of that. But
it's that kind of stuff, right? It's people always think like, oh, you're going to make them famous. No, it's even something simple as following a journalist on Twitter. And if they're like, hey, I'm looking for a quote on this, you're like, oh, man, you should talk to my employee. That kind of stuff. They all someone really wants to know in this entire world for everything is, does someone have my back, right? Do I feel appreciated? And the way I show appreciation is in these ways. You may show them in a different way. You may show them in a different way. It just to each their own. And as long as people feel appreciated, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, they'll work for less money. They'll work for for longer hours, but they're doing it because they feel like it's giving some value to their life. And I'm not saying this is a form of lip service. I'm not saying, haha, you can manipulate employees. It's more if it aligns with who they are and aligns with what you're doing. My God, like, things become 100x easier to do. When we had a hiring call about 2 years ago on examine.com, we had over 500 PhDs apply for one position because reputation and all that kind of stuff. But they all knew like, hey man, no one ever leaves, right? Once they're into the damn ecosystem, they're stuck with Examine. There's gotta be something going on. People talk, the cookie up, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So that's kind of my viewpoint on that is it just makes your life easier if your employees know they have or you have their back. Internally, you may have to yell at them. You may have to scold them. You might have to pull the man. I'm disappointed in this. I expected better from you because that always hurts way more. But publicly, I will fiercely protect any and all employees against anybody. Even if my employees are wrong, I will still, they know that I will like have their back just because that's how it works.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah. That's a great model. And in a nutshell, it sounds like you're saying appreciate your employees and their value to you will appreciate.
Oh. For sure. For sure.
Now, also, you know, you keep it very lean. Oh, no pun intended with your, you know, business being about fitness. But you sell three products. Is that still accurate? Three.
Correct.
And
at this time,
you have brought in 8 figures of revenue over the years.
Yes.
How? Why?
I mean, at the end of the day, this is the best part of the internet, though, right? Is revenue is just a function of products are selling and distribution of the products. So we may have three products, and we actually have like 2 or 3 coming out next year. Admittedly, considering we're almost 8 years old, 3 products is a very, very, very low number, and the market is demanding a lot of things from us. But at the end of the day, right, a digital product is pure margins. You simply figure out what value someone ascribes to what you're offering. And then distribution is the other key part. So in our context, we are pretty much the only organization that analyzes supplement research that's not selling supplements. So it's not just us selling it, right? It's everyone else in the fitness industry, in the nutrition industry. They know that, one, we're reliable, but most importantly, they know we don't do coaching. And because we don't do coaching, they know we're not going to try to steal any of their clients. So if they send them to examine.com or if they're like, hey, buy examine.com's guide, they know all that's going to happen is someone will buy our product and that's it, right? No registered dietitian, no nutritionist, no personal trainer. Nobody has to worry about losing a customer to us.
So you see how basically how to play nice with others. This, and again, comes back in what I'm hearing is relationships.
At the end of the day,
relationships within the fitness industry, and you don't do any affiliate links, any paid, anything, but you have relationships with these vendor service providers, and they all refer to you instead of someone else because you have the content, the expertise, the unbiased opinions, and that's it. You're not
their pie. A few things there. One of them is there is so much money online that you just need to make like 0.0001% and you're pretty damn wealthy right off the bat. Like the amount of money, like what is it, $450 billion now is just online US retail alone. Like you don't need to get much of a marketplace to make a lot of money.
Yeah, you don't need a big slice of the pie.
Exactly. It's a huge, the pie is like, you cannot fathom how giant this pie is.
That's a big cookie. That's a big cookie.
Yeah, it is a deliciously big cookie. The other side of it too, though, is when you think about it from their perspective, they want to have like trusted partners, and part of the trust is that I'm very blunt about everything. I'm like, listen, this is what we're selling. This is how much we charge. This is how much we'll give as affiliate fee. By the way, we don't link to anybody. We don't promote anyone else. By setting the relationship off the bat, there's no confusion. They know exactly what they're going to get. They know exactly what to expect. I actually have a page on my own personal blog, and examine.com has the same policy, where I basically say, don't send me anything. Like, anytime people ask me for my address, like, I want to send you a gift, I want to send you this, I literally send them the link, and it basically says, I don't do testimonials, I don't vouch, I don't recommend anybody, I'll do some random recommendations because I just like someone's stuff. Here's my address, but don't send me anything. And if you do send me, like, a book or anything, I'm not even gonna donate your book. I'm just gonna recycle that book. Don't give it to me. So it's part of that, like that reputation when we're talking about the network. People know Saul is this like uptight ass, but his team does proper research, so we feel comfortable recommending it. And also, we know not to bother asking him for any kind of quid pro quo because we know he's gonna say no. And you're gonna be like, wait, this is one sided, whatever. And he's gonna be like, listen, man, there's no one like us. You can send your employees or patients or whatever, clients, wherever you want.
Yeah.
That's your decision. So that's kind of our, it's almost a very take it or leave it, but I'm a big believer in saying no, and this is an extension of that right there.
No, that's really cool. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm every day more and more a believer and subscriber to the principle of no, every day increasingly more. I want to take this back to domain name. So you talked about, you know, you just mentioned your personal blog.
Yeah.
You've got a phenomenal domain name on the personal blog with SKO.com. You've got a phenomenal domain name with Examine, with Examine.com. I think you own a few other domain names. I think pet.org. I don't know if you've flown that or not.
Yeah, that was going to be my next project.
Okay. And I know you had some others. I don't recall, but, you know, I've heard of some from past discussions. And
yeah.
But I don't know what's public knowledge. I know you mentioned pet on another podcast, so I thought I could say it. But talk to us about your domains. I mean, or Tess, yeah, I don't know if you have a specific question.
I got some specific questions for you.
Okay.
First of all, Saul, you have so many really amazing accomplishments that every time that I listen to a podcast, there's like, oh, there's one that says you were 15 when you graduated college. True or false?
Pretty sure that's not true, but
let's just say, checking.
Why not?
Okay. I'll send you that link.
Okay.
But anyway, so after you were 15 and graduated college and a millionaire, at 15, you started out, you were online gaming, you moved a lot, online gaming, what kid doesn't like. And then you started figuring out selling virtual currency, right?
Yep.
And then it's like, blah, blah, there were some successes, some failures, and here are these other amazing things, you know, your local search,
right.
Your examine.com. But in the middle there, there's always this like part, it doesn't even get its own full sentence, that you were really into domaining for a short while. What were you doing?
Okay.
Were you trying to flip domains? Were you just domain investing? What, I know that now you hold around 100 domains. Like, did you have 5,000 domains at a time? Tell us that story, however brief that time was.
So what originally happened was, so I was in virtual currency online games, right? So EverQuest had EverQuest Platinum, World of Warcraft had WoW Gold, all these kind of, that was the currency names. And so in like 2001 is when we started playing the SEO game. And like 2002, Google was kind of already ascendant. And the way Google worked at the time was once a month it would update rankings. That was it. Otherwise they were static. And so if you were ranked well for that 1 month, like you could make a lot of money. And we realized that one of the things that Google cared a lot about at the time was the name of the website, right? Because those were the links you were getting. And that's when I was like, okay, if I'm trying to rank high for EverQuest Platinum, why don't I just buy EverQuestPlatinum.com and build a website on it? Like, it's so rudimentary. So that's how I originally got into domain names. And what started happening was we started acquiring like the short form and the currency names. So what I mean by that is there was a game called Matrix Online. It was MXO.com. So we had it was called MXO, so we bought MXO.com. There was Final Fantasy XI, so we got FFXI.com. And then there was the currency ones. Actually, our aforementioned friend Chris owned WildGold.com because, you know, that was the big currency there. So EQ Platinum, all of them, that's how we got started. So that's how I originally got started. And for me, everything is like, ooh, what kind of edge case can I take it to? So when I heard about domain names, I'm like, cool, let's just see what's going on. And that's how I ran into DN Forum, like in 2002, 2003, I don't even know, all the numbers are vague. And originally I was like, cool, like, you know, domain names were hot, then they kind of died, and maybe they're coming back, you know, let's buy a few. So the best one I had was beat.com, B-E-A-T. I had like webmaster.org and a few other ones. And I don't know what I was doing. So webmaster.org, I started developing into a website. Beat.com, I was like, oh, let's see how much we can sell it for. We flipped it for 100% in 6 months. But I am not the kind of person who likes stuff like flipping. It's too stressful for me. To each their own, right? For me, I'm like, man, I've got this asset, now I gotta sell it for more, and I gotta find out where to sell it. Or if you're trying to buy, you gotta go find and harass people or call them. I'm like, man, I'm on the internet because I don't want to call people. You gotta like I'm good with follow-ups, but you gotta be a little bit persistent. So I was like, ah, this seems like a lot of effort.
Sorry, I am that guy. I'm, you know.
So that is who you are.
That is who I am. So you make a very good point about you know flipping assets is not your cup of tea, and I think that's a really important point that a lot of our audience unfortunately misses, and I know that because of comments and emails that we get. There are probably three different camps of sort of high-level entrepreneurs, in my experience. And one camp is like deal makers, like me. So for me, there's like virtually zero stress and only enjoyment in the hunting for the deal, buying something that you feel is undervalued, and then either proactively trying to sell it or simply sitting on it and waiting until, you know, the market appreciates to the value that you recognized in the beginning. And then there's the camp of like, I don't even know what the second camp, I don't know what to call it, but the people who are like the coordinators, they love to, they're the glue, and they don't operate, bring together all of the pieces. And then there's the builders. And those are the people like you that just, they want to build something. I want to, you know, I've got an idea, I've got a brand, and I want to build a business on it. I have no interest in selling it. I'm just looking to just build this thing. And so those are three very distinct camps of entrepreneurs at a very high level. And it's really important to recognize which camp you fit into.
Yes.
Because if you're a builder and you're out there trying to be a domain speculator, well, you're going to run into problems because the two mindsets they don't align very well. And I have friends, like my friend Franz, who's also been on here, also lives in Panama, Dutch guy, you know, very, very successful in lead gen, the owner of PX.com. And, you know, he's tried his hand being a domain flipper, but it stresses him out. And by the time he gets it, he's already tired. He's like, I want to just sell it because I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And yep. I'm like, well, I've got, you know, 5,000 domains that I've got no idea what I'm going to do with. I have no intention of doing anything with them. I just know that I bought them undervalued. And, you know, it gives me, you know, comfort knowing that I've got all these assets that are undervalued.
For sure.
But knowing which camp you fall into is so critical in order to make good decisions.
So you were young, in your early 20s, you dabbled and you figured out you're a builder, but your time in domains gave you some insight into what domains to build on.
Yeah, for sure.
To maximize your effort, right?
For sure. If I'm to be a little bit honest and mean about people in the domain space, there's great delusions of grandeur. It blows my mind how much people overvalue their own assets. It's honestly mind-boggling. Like, would I pay, like, you'll see the exact same domain name, but someone else owns it, and like, man, I wouldn't pay $100 for it. And then when you're trying to sell, you're like, man, I want at least $10,000 for it. For me, the domain name was just an extension of how memorable are you. Online, especially being memorable is very, very important. So, you know, we could have done examinesupplements.com. We could have done supplementresearch.com. Nat Cohen, actually, he owns owned supplement. I don't know if I can say this, but it's already out. Supplement.com. You know, we had a lot of options of what we could have gone after, but Examine was just a very easy to remember domain name. So, sorry, going back. So,
if you know, I tried correctly. I think I actually inquired about the name from Nat for you.
Oh, there we go.
Via Chris. I think Chris asked me to look into it for you.
What is forward? I love how everything's interconnected. Yeah. So I tried the speculation thing, and it was just a hassle to like the domain name. Then you also have to worry about like escrow. Is someone to steal your domain name? All these, like, especially the international headaches. I was like, man, I don't need this in my life. And so instead what I decided was, I think actually if I've ever said this, when most people don't know this, I was like, you know what, I'm going to retire to New Zealand. You know what, I'd like to have a few like New Zealand websites. I'm like, all right, if I'm going to have New Zealand websites, I should just buy some New Zealand domain names. So I went out and I bought like movies.co.nz, I think sports.co.nz, news, I can't remember, s.co.nz, q.co.nz, lawyers, attorneys, that kind of stuff, with the idea eventually being I'm going to build something. So for me, domain names went from, ooh, this is something to rank higher with, to, ooh, this is like an appreciable asset like real estate, to, ooh, I want to only buy domain names that I would like to eventually build upon. At this time, my number two was an American in the Philippines. So we also bought a lot of Filipino domain names. We lucked out that the biggest or like the main company that owned some of the top domain names from like the mid-90s, computers.com.ph, sex, books, education, business, real estate, all of them, I don't know if they were divesting or they're going under, so we bought all their top domain names. So I still have these Filipino domain names. I still have these New Zealand domain names, but all the non-ccTLD of those two, it more just became like, hey, I'm actually going to build something on this. So for example, my next project is meant to be pets. Like 4 years ago or 3 years ago, I bought petscience.com. And then pet.org came up and I was like, ooh, that's such a cooler domain name. Let me buy that one. So I bought pet.org. So to me, yeah, domain names were just, and what's really interesting, especially in the tech space, you know, for example, in the early 2000s, Flickr was huge, right? But it didn't have that E. So being able to tell people, yeah, man, I own webmaster.org. And they're like, how do you spell webmaster? I'm like, I don't know. Is the actual word, you weirdo? Or examine.com. Any of those, you can tell people are like, oh, okay. And I've had this so many times. I've had over 100 people tell me, like, how do you spell examine? I'm like, what are you talking about? How do you spell examine? Like, did you not go to grade school? But obviously, you know, they're thinking, like, there's no E or there's, like, three X's or some – that'd be a porn site. There are two X's or whatever's going on. So that's always been nice also. And the other last component of it is if you want to rank high in Google, truly rank high right now, authority matters. And the best way to get authority is to get it from the mainstream media. Right? If you get a link from New York Times, Washington Post, whatever, it's a lot easier to rank high. And if you go to a journalist and you're like, hi, I'm from myshittydomain.com or .co.in or whatever, versus hi, I'm from sjo.com, automatically, we talked about heuristics a little bit, automatically they're like, wait a minute, this person must be serious and or real, because that's obviously not a garbage domain name. So I'm even more, I actually wrote an article maybe a year ago about like, oh, this is why I spent, you know, a lot of money on domain names. And then someone republished it on Entrepreneur or Forbes, like talking about the context of, hey man, we don't talk about this, but domain names can be pretty damn powerful. So that's how I got into domain names, and that's how I kind of got out of domain names, because it was not the life for me at all.
No, super cool. It sounds like it gave you a foundation for what is the life for you. I totally have to ask. So you've been very open that you've changed your name when you were just starting out, and you also bought SJO when you were just starting out. I just think every domainer, you know how we think. What came first? Did you pick your name based on available TLD?
No, okay, so some context. I've been at this now for 19 years. I legally changed my name, let's say 9 years ago. Being the dunce that I am, I failed the paperwork 3 times in a row. The first time I hadn't filled it out correctly. The second time they're like, sir, you haven't signed this. I was like, oops. The third time they're like, sir, your credit card is expired, because I'd taken so many times to get the paperwork done right. So it took me like a year to get the name change in the first place. But no, SJO actually has no bearing on my name. I just bought it because it's a 3-letter domain name and it's much easier to remember. And at the end of the day, also the reason I acquired domains for stuff like this is, if it fails, I can still pretty much liquidate it for 75% of the purchase price. So even if I lose money, there's still money. It's like Arrested Development. There's always money in the banana stand. I could sell examine.com and lose some money, but I'll still suddenly have cash in my hand. Same thing with SJO. Yeah. Same thing with everything else. So yeah, the SJO was actually, I only bought it like 3 or 4 years ago. It just so happened that the S and O line up and everyone thinks I have a middle name that starts with J, but I have no middle name.
You can change just, that if you want.
Yeah, I could actually. You know what? I could. There's a lot of possible J's that come in there, but it was pure happenstance and coincidence. There was literally no.
Just couldn't resist. I did. I've mentioned this before on Sherpa. I did know a gentleman who named his son, his middle name is Google, so that he could buy domain names with Google in them. So, wow. I mean, domainers are committed people. Committed. So, I just didn't know
some of it's like a mix of impressment and also like what the hell is currently going on in my head.
Yeah.
Agreed. Now, Drew, I was surprised right now that you agreed when Saul said, you know, if the project doesn't work out, he can always liquidate the domain for 75% of the value. I thought you would jump in and say, nuh-uh, domains are generally, I mean, you like to say no asset class has appreciated more in the last 20 years than domain names. So I challenge you to challenge him.
Well, no, I do agree. I mean, I don't remember exactly what Saul paid.
It was roughly 30,000 for SJO.
Yeah, so he's pretty much spot on. I mean, I think, you know, the liquid value right now of a threeletter.com with an O on the end is, you know, in the area of $23,000 to $25,000. And so he's pretty much spot on. You know, he'd lose 15 to 20% if he had to sell it right now at wholesale cost, you know, fire sale.
Yeah, that's the key part. If I had to sell it, that's the idea. Exactly. Not that I would sell it, but if I had to get 10, 20,000 in cash, I have a little asset that I can get rid of instantly.
Absolutely. There's a degree of liquidity to these things. And so, you know, with domain names, there's always there's a graph and, you know, there's time and there's value. And so the longer your time preference, the higher the likelihood of a above liquidity value sale. No, what I was mostly agreeing with when Saul made that statement was the fact that what all startup founders should recognize, particularly startup founders, is that domain names put a backstop on their investors' investment. And even though it may be a very small fraction of the overall investment, it still gives people a warm and fuzzy feeling that they're investing into something that has a asset on the balance sheet. It's not, you know, a couple of kids with cool idea, big dreams, and, you know, a pipeline. They've got infrastructure, and that infrastructure is, you know, this valuable domain name that's got a liquid value that if the shit hits the fan, they've got an asset which can be sold. They've got an asset they can put a lien against. They've got an asset that puts a backstop on that investment, and it shows investors that entrepreneur understands that the most important investment they're going to make in their business is their brand, particularly if it's consumer facing. And secondly, that they're putting skin in the game, not just their time, because from an investor, a VC standpoint, if you're going that route, VCs aren't going to put a high value on your time, but they are going to put a high value on what you are putting in. And so that can be execution and output, but also, have you put skin in the game, meaning what cash have you taken out of your pocket to put in this? Because if you've taken out cash out of your pocket to invest into this business, then it tells them that, you know, you've got a lot to lose. And the more somebody's got to lose, the harder they're going to work to not lose it. Sure. That aligns investors' interests with founders' interests.
The one thing I'd like to add is a domain name is important, but it's not the only thing. And this is kind of where the schism happens. And it's kind of funny. In tech space, they're like, it's $10, I'll buy a domain. In the domain space, is like, you must buy the world's greatest domain name possible. To me, it's like, if you have a $100,000 budget, you can spend $10,000 on a domain, you can spend $15,000, you'll get a pretty solid domain. But that's what domainers are like, $80,000 on a domain, whereas tech guys again are like, $10. So I think this is part of the schism, is like, you can find solid domain names, three-letter domain names for 20, 25, 30, 40 even, and you don't need to use your entire damn budget. Use some of it, just don't blow the entire thing. And like, I say that all the time for exam, and I'm like, yeah, you know what? It was, I think, $42,000 was how much exam cost. But we had another $100,000 to spend on like the actual development of the company, not just, we have examine.com. Shit, we ran out of money. let's take a job at Starbucks to cover our costs. So I think that's the important factor that a lot of people don't always follow through correctly on that.
So at
but
first,
I think also there's a caveat to that, which is it depends on the scope of your business and what your ambitions are. So if you're trying to build the next Amazon, Google, Facebook, Twitter, then I think it is really critical to get the absolute best version.com domain name at the earliest possible timing you can. And if you're not trying to build that, you're trying to build a SaaS product, you're trying to build a niche community, you're trying to build, you know, something that where you already know going into it that, you know, even if I'm not saying the scope is limited to something small, but the scope is limited to, I know who my audience is going to be and it's never going to be more than that. well, then I think it's a far less important to, you know, sort of, I don't want to say, again, nobody should go all in on their budget, because then how do you build the business? But the ratio of how much of your budget should go towards your domain, I think depends on who your audience is. Is it consumer facing? How much of your traffic is going to be coming directly to your website versus through other channels? You know, how are you going to achieve distribution? And, you know, like, so one of the questions I wanted to ask you before very specifically is, if you were saulshealthtips.com or kamalshealthtips.com or, you know, even healthtips.com, how can you give us, can you make a tangible, give us a tangible metric about how much harder it would have been to get those expert opinions without paying for them? How much harder would it be to, you know, make those contacts that you've made, to get those links that you've gotten, to get, you know, you brought it up that it's a lot easier to get a journalist to link back to you or utilize your information as opposed to another website because of the exam.com.
Yeah, especially at the beginning, because what you just said, you spent 30% of your startup capital on examine.com, on your domain name. So it must have been pretty important to you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's obviously impossible to quantify. I am obsessed with probability. I'm obsessed with heuristics. So having a better domain name is just a heuristic that signals you're serious, right? So Kamal's Health Tips is obviously far inferior to healthtips.com, which is relatively quite inferior to something like examine.com. Part of it is also examine.com, you kind of flex with it because you're like, I'm not just focused on one little thing. We are a generic name, and this is what we're choosing to examine at the moment in time. So yeah, it's obviously impossible to quantify, but I mean, I always just say, like, stick your, you know, pretend like you're someone else, and how would you respond? If I'm a journalist and someone emailed me and like, hi, I'm from kamalshealthtips.com, I'm like, who's this tool? But if someone was like, hi, I'm from examine.com, I'm like, whoa, what's this organization, right? And I might find out that examine.com is nothing. I might find out kamalshealthtips.com is a huge organization. I might dig into it. But it's just another signal to say, hey, I'm serious versus, you know, I'm just kind of lounging around. On the internet especially, there's a huge issue with professionalism in a way. Most people I find are very, very amateur. So having a nice domain name is a very clear signal off the bat. It's like a first impression of like, I'm a professional. At which point then, you know, you may go to the website and you're like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. Obviously there's no 100%, but it definitely makes life easier. Yeah. And more importantly, almost, it makes your life easier down the road. It's like, you know, calling, building a brand around your personal brand or your organizational brand. It's easier to do personal brand off the top. It's easier to kind of do, let's say, in a way, a non-generic, but down the road when you have like 30 employees or 40 employees or whatever, it's much easier to be a generic domain name, just like it's much easier to be not about you versus the organization.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned your dreams about New Zealand and your New Zealand domain investments, because I just interviewed a gentleman, I'm going to butcher his last name, Adrian McKean, I don't remember, but Adrian was really fascinating guy, and he is a native New Zealander, and he bought makeup.co.nz as the primary brand for a business that he and his business partner founded and co-run. And he said a key, so New Zealand has all these interesting different uses of their ccTLD than a lot of other countries do. And they also, did you know Amazon doesn't even, yeah, this might affect your desire to retire there. Amazon doesn't deliver to New Zealand, like today, it's 2018.
Interesting.
They don't deliver to
New Zealand. Is really tiny. I don't think people appreciate. If I was like, I think the population of New Zealand is smaller than the population of Toronto.
Wow. I believe it.
Tiny.
So he said because of his domain name, he got key deals with suppliers that he could call and leave a message and say, hey, it's Adrian with makeup.co.nz. and they'd call him back. They're willing to do a deal with him. And they're basically, they are the makeup supplier for the country.
Brilliant.
So he was able to put some kind of tangible value on what the how the domain developed key partnerships for him. Can you beat that story?
Unfortunately,
you have a story like that with it, when you were starting out with Xamen, or even if you don't have some fascinating story, was that your general experience?
There was definitely times when people were surprised that we owned Xamen.com, for sure. Especially with the website back then looked super garbage. I just threw something up. There was definitely people that were a little bit confused. Not confused. They would mention like, oh, like that's a really great domain name. How'd you get it? I still get that question all the time, which is why I eventually wrote about why I've spent so much money on domain names. definitely, it is something people notice. In a way, I think that's fascinating now is that because we're so established, it's no longer that much of an issue. And also because we have a team, right? If I emailed you examine.com, like, yeah, it's my personal domain name. You're like, what is going on with you, right? But if I'm like, oh, yeah, we have 30 people working on examine.com, you're like, yeah, okay, it sounds like a company. So it's funny in a way, it's actually kind of gone down, or at least the surprise has gone down. But I'm sure the brand itself is, I mean, you know you're a strong brand when the top searches you're getting for your from Google are your own brand name, Xamen and Xamen.com. And it's not like we don't rank high for a lot of things and get a lot of traffic for a lot of keywords. So yeah. I think that's how we know that we made the right move at the end of the day.
That's a great, I think, goal for a lot of businesses and branding. When they're just, they already know your brand. They're just trying to find you. That's a big deal. That's
for sure.
Deal.
I'm going to be like, I have to be honest. I'll be a little bit cynical here. I think the domain name industry overrates domain names. And I think everyone else totally underrates domain names. It's an element. Is it the magic sauce? Absolutely not. Is it something that can give you a leg up? Absolutely. Especially depending on your industry, right? Some industries domain names don't matter as much. If you're going pure consumer play, then it doesn't matter as much. But when I say as much, it depends, right? If you're selling mattresses and you have mattress.com, that's cool. But if you have something like launchpad.com, that's also cool, which might be much cheaper than mattress.com. But, you know, getyourmattress.com might not be the right one. It's all about the balance. And I think a lot, and it's funny, like I've talked to domainers for 15 years now talking about how they're going to build websites. And when they tried, like, oh shit, this is a lot harder than I thought. It's one of those things, right? Where when you actually try to build it out, it's one of those, you have to experience it. When you actually try to build it out, you're like, oh, okay, the domain name gives me a leg up, but it's not going to solve my business, right? It's not going to make everyone flock to me and be like, oh my God, shut up and take my money. So there's that element of like, yeah, it's super important, especially if you're not in the domain name industry, you're missing out on a lot of things. Fun fact, I don't know if they still do this, Y Combinator, which is one of the most well-known incubators, what they used to have their cohorts do is literally look up 1,000 domain names and then pick one of the easier sounding domain names. That's how Stripe happened. I think that's how eventually Mint happened, just to make sure that it's easy to remember. So there are people who appreciate the value of domains. It's just sometimes I find domainers definitely vastly overstated because you need that experience of actually trying to build an organization and they're like, oh shit, makes life easier, but doesn't solve. Which is oftentimes the dichotomous relationship right there.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's like kind of a bit of a polarization in opinions. And I think as the market matures and as, I mean, domain names are still so new in terms of concepts of marketing, branding, that I think it takes people like you who are successful and respected in the entrepreneurial field and yet balanced in knowing that it was worth it to invest 30% of your capital in a domain name, but not everyone should do quite that amount. You know, it really takes that, and I appreciate that. You know, you've spoken about your social responsibility, like you're not huge on building your brand and running around, your personal brand and running around with your, you know, ego cape. But you're here and thank you for that. So I've seen over time, we've tried to acquire businesses or domains that people have set up on their personal domain name. Like, my name is Tess Diaz, TessDiaz.com. Imagine if it was that instead of DomainSherpa.com. Like, I've seen that over the years, and it's a train wreck. But you've really been smart and attentive about that from the beginning. How did you see that, and how do you envision those coexisting and supporting each other, but not bleeding boundaries into each other?
So, I mean, there was no master plan behind it, to be honest. I was just a shy kid, and I was like, I don't want people to know who I am. So it just worked out really well for me that building the non-personal brand. The other side of the personal brand that's interesting to me is a lot of these personal brands are relatively fleeting, right? They might be hot today. They might be hot in a couple of years, but then no one remembers them in 5 years. And like, if we actually take a step back and look at most personal brands, a lot of them are built around gimmicks. Remember, there's this guy in fitness who blew up. He had like a million Instagram followers because he would be eating while working out. There's a video of him like lifting, overhead pressing a barbell, and like someone's feeding him a turkey leg. Nobody remembers him anymore, right? Because it gets boring. It's insidious. It's ridiculous. It's insane. That's the word I was looking for. And so to me, like, the personal brand then becomes an extension. To me, a personal brand is, what are my opinions and thoughts? If you see me on social media, I've only ever shared one picture of my girlfriend. I've never shared a picture of my dog. I've had him for over 9 years now. To me, a personal brand is like, these are the things going on in my head. And I will say, I got like the nicest comment ever the other day. I wrote something about like how my dog doesn't care about me, but when I've got food, he's like my best friend. And the guy comments, he's like, man, sometimes you say like the smartest things that I would have never thought of. And then sometimes you post stuff that people would when they were brand new to Twitter. And I was like, thank you so much. That legitimately in a great way matters, because what's happening is, there's this weird sense of always being brilliant, always being on, always being full of knowledge, and like being the smartest person in the room or world or whatever. And so what I found, like, in terms of how does the personal brand possibly help the main brand, the personal brand gives a level of humanity to who I am. It gives a personal level of humanity to all the employees around Examine.com. Kamal, for example, talks a fair amount of politics. I'll talk about a fair amount of just the most random stuff. I spent like a week talking about like dick pics, about like, why is there no AI that recognizes it? So if you get a dick pic, it like censors it out. And then I was like, man. And then
we leased out nu.de. So the 2-letter.de domain, but it spells nude, right? Domain hack.
That is beautiful.
We leased it out to a Berkeley, I think they were Berkeley, or two Chinese kids, really smart from Berkeley, who had built an AI. They built a program called Nude for your phone. You download it, and it artificially had an AI that would scan all of your new pictures that you received by Messenger, WhatsApp, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter how you received it or if you took it yourself, and it would automatically grab any, you know, dick pics or whatever nude pictures, and it would grab them and put them in your vault, and you have the Nude vault. That was an encrypted vault, so that like nobody could, you know, get a hold of your phone or hack your phone, or you're like, oh, here, mom, look at my pictures from my,
It is terrifying to hand your phone to someone else.
And it's like, oh my God, what were you doing topless on stage? You know, so I thought it was pretty clever. And we gave them a lease to own deal, and we were going to get some equity in the business, but they ended up defaulting. And basically they were like, crazy smart, both going into like the aerospace industry.
Right.
This was like, you know, a project that they thought of.
This actually happens. It's funny you mentioned this happens so much in entrepreneurship, where there's like brilliant people, but people forget, like, a business is really simple. There's a difference between simple and easy, right? Like, losing weight is simple. It's just not easy. Building a business solves a problem. That's it. You need to solve someone's problem. But really, the key part that I always find interesting about businesses is you need to solve the actual problem. I'm going to segue in a second, but I'm doing this. There's a company called Precision Nutrition here in Toronto. They're worth a couple $100 million. They do nutrition coaching. Someone on some forum commented saying like, hey, you know, would you recommend Precision Nutrition? And this person responded being like, I would not. I did their program. I didn't reach, I felt like my coach didn't really care about me. I didn't bother reaching out to the coach, but I feel like she would not have responded anyway. I did lose 30 pounds, but I would not recommend Precision Nutrition. Now, if you are a business and you read this and you're like, what the hell is wrong with you, woman? You lost 30 pounds. Like, we literally did exactly what we promised you. But the reality of it is that people are not losing weight for the sake of losing weight. The actual problem is people feel disconnected. They feel non-confident. They don't feel like they're part of a community. Yeah. And so the organization actually doubled down on the coaching component of like reaching out, how are you doing, texting, messaging. They built software just to build up the coaching component, and it worked. And it obviously they did really, really well. So I just wanted like the random tangent, like people, like these smart people, I come across it all the time. Like, I've got this idea, I've got that idea. I'm like, that's great. But are you actually solving a big problem? Yeah, maybe, you know, handing your phone to your mom is a problem, but are you paying a subscription service to just make sure the one out of three months